At the beginning of the week, Gil talked about retreat practice as a journey. Now it's just think of all the amazing and wonderful and terrible places we've been this week. just by sitting here. And so I'm very grateful to be join you or be some witness for you, and very meaningful for me. So one way to think about this journey, and to think about the journey of Buddhist practice, is a kind of shift. We come in with this strong sense of the world according to me, the world according to my preferences, my way. And maybe that shift, or some part of that shift, is about simply being a part of it all. Letting who we are, letting ourself be made and remade, in each moment, the conditions of each moment. And then thinking about it in this way, our suffering, our difficulties, are not necessarily something to be deleted, but in a way to be thanked, because the suffering was the doorway into the practice. Everything that's ever happened in our life has brought us to this point, and so. Suffering, in a way, is the door we enter through, enter this path to becoming whole. So as we near the end of the transition of this, particular leg of the journey, I wanted to share some thoughts about transitioning from retreat, in ways that we can bring the practice home with us. How we can bring the practice into our daily life and out into the world. One of the wonderful things about retreat is the conditions are set up that make it so supportive for practice. The silence, the simplicity, the support. So what we often say is that as difficult as retreat can be at times during the retreat, retreat is actually the easiest place to practice. It's out in our life, that's the advanced practice. And so the principle is we go into retreat in order to come out of it. If we're only happy during retreat, if we're only calm and settled and tranquil and free during retreat, it's not... It has a limited value. So the dynamic is we come on retreat and we look very closely, we look very carefully into what's happening right here. And so we zoom in. And then we come out, we zoom out, and we find it everywhere. And in a way, this transition time, the time of leaving retreat and going back into our life, you know, can be the most meaningful, the most significant aspect of the retreat. So this is a pivot point. It's like, you know, one way I think about it is if you have a house, you know, and it's filled with all kinds of stuff that we just, you know, accumulate over our life. And we take, you know, one by one, we take every single thing that's in the house out. The furniture, the books, the clothing, the carpets, I don't know, the upholstery. And so we array it in front of us. It's like on the front lawn. And so that's the opportunity of retreat. You know, we're cleaning house. And then we get to decide what to bring back in. You know, what do we need? What are the objects that bring us delight? This is a little bit of an aside, but I was reading about this Japanese woman who is a consultant for people. Maybe you saw this article in the New York Times. And she helps you to organize your house, your closet. And the way she does it is she stands right next to you and holds up each thing that's in your house, in your closet. Yeah. And then in that moment, you have some feeling. And what determines whether you keep it or you get rid of it is, does this bring me joy and delight? You know, so some article of clothing or some book or something. And so anyway, that's... she said, you have to get rid of all your paper, because paper can never bring joy or delight. Okay. You know, so we have this opportunity. All of our stuff is laid out in front of us. And what do we pick up? What do we bring back in? And what do we bow to and say, you know, thank you for your service. This has, you know, this has outgrown its usefulness, and you know, and we don't need it anymore, and we can let it go. You know, so what are the habits? What are the thought patterns? What are the ideas? What are the ways of being that we just don't need anymore? And so coming out of retreat is just a really interesting, a really rich time to watch ourselves. One of the classical pieces of advice is go slow, especially with talking and interactions and things like that. My first few retreats, I sort of ignore this advice, and you can see what your experience is, but I got a big headache. You know, everyone wants to talk. And it's very hard from within the retreat to sense how we've slowed down, you know, and how perception has sharpened. So just, you know, being sensitive to that. And I once asked my wife, you know, or I usually do after retreat, you know, like, do I seem different? And she always says, there are two things that seem different about me. One is when I get out, you know, sometimes, especially if it's a longer retreat, The eyes can be bigger, you know. So there's something about sometimes people will notice that your pupils are wider or your eyes are more open. And she finds this a little scary. You know, it's like when I look at her, she's like, you know. It's like, and then the second thing she says is that she can tell something's different because usually I get a little bit cranky when I'm hungry. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's 12 o'clock, you know, we're not eating yet. It's 1, it's 2. I start to, you know, she said, well, where should we go? You know, I don't know, just do somewhere. It doesn't matter. And, but after retreat, it's like, you know, just happy. And no, it's okay. I don't mind. Wherever you want. And so she calls that Max's magic. And the slightly sad thing is that Max's magic fades after a while. This a week, 2 weeks. So part of the joy of coming back to our life is you'll discover, you know, what is your magic. And the ways that you've changed and the ways that you feel different. So transition from retreat can be a special opportunity to pause and to see our life in a different way. You know, just like the rain this morning cleans the air. I'm always happy when it rains because, you know, it's a free car wash. And and how great it is to get in the car and this clean windshield and that we can see through. And so in a way, retreat is like cleaning the windshield of our mind. And it's possible to see our life in a different way, you know, from a different vantage point. So this can be one of the great gifts of retreat and one of the great gifts coming out. It's like to pause and take stock and reflect on our life, reflect on our priorities. You know, transitions are often times for reflection. You know, you think about the milestones of life, graduating from school, you know, getting married, starting a family, the life changes, divorces, death, loss of a loved one, you know, a significant medical diagnosis. You know, these are transitions that can present a special opportunity. So when we think about, you know, what's happened here this week, what we've seen in ourselves, what we've seen in others, you know, we don't know fully how we've changed. But maybe one question we can hold is, you know, what, you know, how can I live in a way that honors what's happened here? How can I live in a way that reflects that change? When I lived at the Zen monastery, there's something called the Han, which is this wooden, this block of wood, and there's a wooden mallet, wooden hammer, and it gets, you know, hit before meditation, and then on the face of the wood is a poem, is a kind of reminder. And the one that I always walk by and I love to read every time is, it said, "Great is the matter of birth and death. Life is fleeting. Awake, awake to the great matter. Don't waste time." You know, so we have the gift of this precious human life. And so something about, you know, this pausing, this stopping and reflecting, to let this experience inform the choices we make in our life. It might be important conversations that we want to have. It might be something about forgiveness, you know. Asking for forgiveness and offering forgiveness. On my first retreat, I had to keep a running list of all the people I wanted to apologize to. You know, that's what was coming up. That's what was, you know, that kind of sensitivity. And so it might be taking a clear look about how we use our time, how we spend our time, and how we use our mental energy. To give something or to give someone time and attention is a form of love, is a form of giving love. So it's, you know, what's really important? What's really, you know, how should we use this precious time? It may be something about, you know, I think about this in the language of caring for the self. You know, often in Buddhist circles, we talk about no self. You know, there is no self, and, you know. And that, you know, and that is a profound insight, a profound perspective. And there's also the other side. There's the side of the self. There's the side of picking up the perspective of the self. Caring for our psychological, emotional well-being. You know, it may be, you know, having the inspiration to learn some skills into how we relate to ourselves, our emotions, our anger, how we communicate, how we care for the relationships in our life. So choosing how we spend our time, you know, and it might be choosing to spend more time with the people in our life who are supportive, wholesome, and uplifting, and less time with people who not as much, you know, who are not as much. One of the things I've often tried to do, you know, in this transition time is something about taking an ethical inventory. You know, and in this practice, that, you know, the practice of ethics, the practice of sila, is one of the three main trainings, and it's the foundation. You know, it's our ethics are what supports and enables the practice of samadhi. And so one of the things that always inspires me, and I think about this topic, is that something about we can start right now. It's like, you know, who among us has never done something naughty? You know, but there's something about learning from our mistakes and letting go of them and being free of them. And from the moment we make that decision right now to live ethically, we begin to reap the benefits of that. You know, so I always find that inspiring. We can always start from now. So there's a quote from the poet David White. I might be paraphrasing it, but he says, "The cure for exhaustion is not rest. It is wholeheartedness." So something about finding the wholeheartedness in our daily life. Giving over to our life. Not withholding, not holding back. So, you know, like we said, daily life in a way is this advanced practice. Just as we've talked about in the meditation, this idea of shifting from the what to the how, shifting from what's happening to how we're relating to it. This is also especially important for our everyday life. You know, I think it's very, very easy to become totally absorbed in the what. And this thinking of having to line up our life, you know, in a certain way, and only then will we be happy, be really loved, be enlightened, be, you know, whatever it is. And then the insight from the meditation can be, it's really in the relationship. The suffering and the freedom is in how we relate to whatever happens. You know, so one way of relating is through the hindrances. You know, we talked about this. Unfortunately, the hindrances aren't just found in the meditation. You know, the meditation, in a way, is the training for how to see them, how to look for them, how to understand how they operate. But if your life is anything like mine, you know, they're all over the place. And it's possible to build one's whole life around a hindrance. At some point after a retreat, it dawned on me just how pervasive fear was operating in my life. It was like, I think I said to the teacher something like, I think fear is present every single moment, you know, it feels like. And you know, so we start to notice these things, or desire. It's like, you know, how many people's lives are built around desire for money, for power, for sex. You know, so so we start to see these hindrances, and we start to see them in a different way. the anger is not yours. The fear is not yours. It doesn't belong to you. It's not who you are. It's this impersonal force. And we start to get very familiar with our own patterns, how we get caught, you know. And so it's not only the pain of living under the hindrances and our perception being clouded by the hindrances, but it's also the opportunity cost. You know, what are we not seeing? What are we not doing? You know, one of the things I mean, this is a little silly example, but when I stopped, you know, being single and dating, and, you know, I was amazed at how much time I had, you know, how much free time I was thinking about, and, you know, the mental energy and time, and, you know, so you can see for yourself what opens up when we can let go of a hindrance. You know, and as Gil said in talking about the senior teachers who he surveyed, who were not perfect, who were not, you know, didn't look like that, but who were so fully themselves and so comfortably in their own skin. And they're like, yeah, this is who I am. So something about that, becoming so familiar with ourselves, you know, we become experts in the particular ways that we get caught. You know, and so, and then the other way of relating that we talked about, as the hindrances recede, the jhanic factors arise. And yes, the jhanic factors are aspects of our experience that can reveal themselves through samadhi, through deep, settled meditation. But they're also can be present in just ordinary moments, you know. And you know, so, vitaka vichara, connecting and holding, connecting and staying. This is the gift of our attention. This is what we can give to others. This is what we can give to what we're doing. You know, one of the things that I realized was how the distractions that I have in my everyday life, you know, things like the phone and the computer and all these things, you know, there's a cost for that. There's a cost for always being connected. And, you know, I say this with a little bit of embarrassment, but my 3-year-old daughter, almost three, she, maybe about 4 months ago, she started carrying her phone around with her everywhere. And what her phone was this red wooden block. You know, she has like a block set. And so that was her phone. And she kind of swiped it and like, oh no, we're such bad parents. You know, and she'd have her phone and, you know, bring it with her to bed and put it over there. And it's like, ah. One of the things we, you know, often she wakes up before me, and she has various strategies to wake me up, you know, so, because I try not to get up before 6 for her, but she, you know, she'll get 5:30 or 5:45, and then, so she has various things. One of her strategies that she knows is to go bring me my phone. So she goes to get it, and at one point she was dropping it on my face, you know, she drops it on me, and then she'll start with, you know, I'm hungry. So she knows that, this is such a, and we started out being so careful. We wouldn't let her look at the screens. We don't look at any screens. We didn't want to kind of influence her developing mind. But now, she knows how to unlock phones. She can open and find pictures. And I mean, something about, taking care with all of these, implements in our life. They're powerful. They're wonderful. But, if we give our priority to this connecting, to this meeting and holding and staying, and it's a beautiful thing. And then the well-being, the ease, and the joy that comes out of that. It's, if you've ever noticed how wonderful it is not to look at your email for a while. I mean, it's great. It's that, through the connection, through the wholehearted engagement, comes the joy, comes the happiness and well-being. So we savor these moments, and the more we look for them, the more we can find them. Now we know what to look for. And then the ekagata, the single-mindedness, the one-heartedness, the power and the beauty of giving our whole being to something. I wanted to say a few just more practical things. One of the aspects of this center, of IRC, that I appreciate is the sense of integration. So it's not just like we sit and walk, but we're all participating in creating the retreat, in managing the retreat. And one important aspect of that is the yogi jobs, is the Sangha service, how we take care of the center. And, so this comes from the great Buddhist monastic tradition of having a kind of reverence for daily activities. So it's not just like, my practice is my sitting, and then, that's the real thing. It's like, the whole world, the whole world is our practice. Everything we do is our practice. It's seamless. There's this seamless whole. And so something about that in our life, our daily activities, our cooking, our cleaning, can we do those with reverence? Can we bring mindfulness, bring wholeheartedness? And it's a way of caring for our life. One of the aspects of practice that people always ask about is establishing a daily sitting practice, and this kind of, often there can be this intention, this wonderful intention, great, I'm gonna sit for an hour in the morning, an hour at night. And I remember after one retreat I did, and it was led by a monk, a Burmese monk, and I was quite happy with the retreat, But there's also, you know, that little bit of greed of, you know, like, my question was sort of like, how can I hold on to this and keep this? And he just, what did he say? I think he just held up four fingers, you know, 4 hours a day. Sit 4 hours a day. That was his. And then he said, and that's for maintenance. 4 hours for maintenance and six for, you know, if you want to grow. And, you know, you can imagine how long that lasted after the, you know, it was gung-ho for the first day. Then, you know, little by little by little. So one of the things is just the recognition that we can't hold on to it. And the point is not to hold on to it. It's, you know, collect our wisdom and keep our, you know, keep our insights and keep our calm and just, you know, if only I can. I have filled notebooks with notes from retreats and my own, you know, insights. And one of the things I found is that I never look at those notes. And there's something about, you know, so we can't hold on to it. And we don't need to hold on to it. That's the great thing. Whatever we've gotten, whatever we've learned, however we've changed, we have that, you know. That's in our bones. That's in our cells. And having a sitting practice every day is a wonderful thing. And it can be incredibly supportive. But something about being realistic with it. And setting realistic goals. And it's like, you know, there's a way to see sitting in our everyday life as like, that's our retreat. We can have a mini retreat every day. And so I often think, even in the kind of busiest or being exhausted, it's like, put the tush on the cush. You know, just to sit down. Just to sit down and just to come into the posture. And there's something about that. And, you know, I say, okay, I'm just going to sit for 1 minute. You know, and of course, often it feels so good. You know, you keep sitting. And often it's like, okay, I just touched into that. And so then that that leads to this other point about what do we need to let go of when we leave retreat? Gil talked today about this fluidity, you know. Can we have an ease and an openness and a willingness with these transitions? So in the meditation sitting, this can be a transition between working with the breath and then a pain in the knee and then some kind of thinking and then some emotion. You know, so a willingness to move and open and shift. And letting that teach us how to have that fluidity in our life. You know, the example that I often think of is, one of my yogi jobs at home is to put our older daughter to sleep every night. And so we go upstairs and we, you know, and sometimes it's easy and sometimes she's agitated and, you know, it takes a while of talking and singing and, you know, and then you start, you know, I'm hungry. And then, you know, over time, you know, she settles down, she falls asleep. And then that's my time to sit. So I, you know, very carefully kind of not to extricate myself, and she's covered, and she's, you know, everything's good, and I kind of crawl over to my zaputan and my zafu, and, you know, a little smile on my face, and sit down and close the eyes and feel the breathing, and you hear papa papa. Should I just pretend I, you know, can hear papa? so being interruptible, you know, and how willing are we to just, you know, it's okay, let go of what we're doing and meet the request of the moment. And this is a very helpful and useful skill in our whole life, you know. Usually, or often, one of the things that comes to mind if someone asks, who are you, you know, or what are you? You know, we say, well, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a teacher, I'm a, you know, a friend, I'm a doctor, a worker. We define ourselves in a way by our function. And so something about that as well, how easily do we move between the different roles that we play in our lives, and how much freedom do we have? You know, one of the gifts of meditation, you know, this ease, this equanimity. So someone asked a question today in the practice discussion of, you know, I'm paraphrasing a little, but could you remind me again, you know, why we're sitting with all this knee pain? You know, and it's a great question, and it's a and so we don't sit with a knee pain over and over so we can be better at dealing with the knee pain in our everyday life, you know. It's like, hopefully, the idea is that in building our willingness and our capacity to be with what's uncomfortable, to be with what's unpleasant, that teaches us something about the nature these things, something about the nature of pain, and not only physical pain but emotional pain. And so you know, something about non-avoidance and acceptance, and that growing confidence in ourselves that we can be mindful of what arises, and we can see that it's not me, you know. So, a monk asked Zen Master Yunmen, what is the teaching of the Buddha's whole lifetime? You know, can you sum up the entirety of the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's teaching? And Yunmen said, an appropriate response. You know, the teaching of the Buddha's whole lifetime is an appropriate response. And so rather than the world according to me and me at the center, you know, as Gil said this morning, the situation is at the center. And so we're responding to the request of this moment, the situation. And, you know, so it's something we discover. You know, it's not like the Dharma is something that is only something that the Buddha taught. And if we can just read every single thing that the Buddha taught, then we know the Dharma. You know, the Dharma comes alive in how we meet the moment, how we respond to the moment. The Dharma isn't somewhere other than within you, you know, right here. The path isn't somewhere else. It isn't in the retreat center, and it isn't in a teacher or a book or something. It's in how we meet ourselves, how we meet the moment. And so it becomes a dance, you know, and that interaction, you know, and having that sensitivity, and having that wholeheartedness, through the wholeheartedness, the dancer becomes the dance, you know. We can't separate the dancer from the dance. So this is Hafiz. Awake a while. It does not have to be forever, but right now. One step upon the sky's soft skirt would be enough. Awake a while. Just one true moment of love will last for days. Rest all of your elaborate plans and tactics, for they are all just frozen spring buds, far, so far from summer's divine gold. Awake, my dear. Be kind to your sleeping heart. Take it out into the vast fields of light and let it breathe. Say, love, give me back my wings. Lift me nearer. Say to the sun and moon, say to our dear friend, I will take you up now on that wonderful dance you promised. Let's just sit for a minute. Awake, my dear. Be kind to your sleeping heart. Take it out into the vast fields of light and let it breathe. Say, love, give me back my wings. Lift me near. Say to the sun and moon, say to our dear friend, I will take you up now on that wonderful dance you promised.